This is Science Friday. I'm John Dankosky. Last week, 97 runners braved the Badwater Ultra Marathon in California, a race five times longer than a standard marathon, with an overall altitude gain of 17,000 feet. And they did it all while enduring 100-degree temperatures, at least during the day, because, yes, they ran at night, too. The fastest finishers hit the 135-mile mark after nearly 24 hours on the trail. The slowest runners after 48 hours. Can you imagine running for 2 days straight? Ultra running is a fast-growing sport here and abroad. There are over a dozen more ultras this weekend alone. That's just in the U.S. But is this sort of racing good for you? My next guests have monitored ultra runners before and after races and documented the sometimes strange ways the body reacts to this extreme exercise. Tamara Hugh Butler is an assistant professor of exercise science at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hugh Butler.
Nice to be here. Thanks, John.
And Greg White is a professor of applied sport and exercise science at Liverpool John Moores University in the UK. He is also performance manager for Team England at the Commonwealth Games going on right now in Glasgow, where he joins us today. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. White.
Thanks very much indeed. It's a pleasure to be on.
And if you run ultra marathons yourself or engage in other extreme exercise, we would love to hear your stories. Our number, 844-724-8255. That's 844-724-SCI-TALK. So, Tamara Hugh Butler, these people who run hundreds and hundreds of miles at a time, are they superhuman in some way?
I think they're mortal like us, but they train really, really hard. And I think that's... like anything else, to be good at it, you really have to practice and you really have to train. So these people put in a lot of time, or they should put in a lot of time, to become good at it and be able to complete it successfully.
And the time that they put in, is this an awful lot of just physical work, or is there something specific about the mental capacity that you need to be able to just stay at something for so long?
I think we talk about the principle of specificity, and I think that also goes with ultra running, whereas if you want to train for something well, you want to actually train in the sport that you're going to do it. So most ultra distance runners will put a lot of their training in on like the weekend, 1 or 2 days. They'll just run really, really long and go through, you know, the trials of having to do that. And I think that makes you mentally tougher as well as physically tougher.
So, Greg White, how about you? Tell us the difference between running a marathon, which already seems an impossibility to me, and running something like 100 miles. I mean, how much different is that on the body, on the athlete?
I mean, it's an interesting point you make, actually. I mean, the bottom line is that marathon running is ultra-endurance running. I think if you put it in the context, the first women's marathon at the Olympic Games wasn't until 1984. If you think the London Marathon didn't actually start until 1982. So, you know, this is a very recent phenomenon. I think what we've done is because, you know, every year in the big city marathons, there are 30 to 50,000 runners participating every year. We've kind of begun to accept that marathon running is almost middle distance. But actually, it is long distance, and it's an incredibly arduous challenge on the body, and obviously particularly the heart. What happens when you extend it beyond the marathon is effectively one of two things happen. Number one is obviously the period of time that you stress the body for increases. But actually what tends to happen is that the intensity at which you exercise actually drops. So it's quite an interesting milieu that goes on for ultra endurance runners who are running 50K up to 100K and even further.
The intensity drops over time?
Effectively, you have to pace yourself. What you can run for 26.2 miles is a very different pace that you're going to be able to sustain for something like a 50 kilometers or 100 kilometers. In the case of some of these really long races you've just mentioned, the Badwater, which is even longer than that. You have to drop the intensity. You have to drop the pace in order to be able to sustain it across time.
We'll get some phone calls in from people who actually take part in these ultra marathons. We'd love to hear from you at 844-724-8255. We want to find out, though, Greg White, if this is something that's actually good for you. Some studies have suggested that running these extreme distances is bad for your heart. It produces scarring on the heart tissue. It may even increase the risk of sudden heart failure and so on. So how dangerous are we talking here?
I think what I have to do is be very, very careful when we talk about this area. I think the one key message that people should understand is that physical activity and exercise is wholly beneficial for health. There are two aspects really to it when we start to go long. One is those individuals who have an underlying condition. So if you have a pre-existing heart disease, then obviously exercise can be problematic. It can precipitate potential events. And then I think also what we find with ultra runners, and this was a study that we published a few years back now, where we did what's called cardiac MRI, and we inject them with a contrast dye called gadolinium. And in that, we can actually identify scarring within the heart muscle itself. And when we looked at ultra endurance runners, now these were serious ultras. So, for example, one of our guys had run 650 marathons and 250 ultras in a lifetime. What we found actually was that half of the cohort, six of the 12 athletes that we looked at, these very serious athletes, had scarring in the heart. Now, the reason for that, we're not clear about. There are some indications. But I mean, what we do know is that for these guys who are repetitively insulting their heart, in other words, what they're doing, what you have to remember here is that it's not only about the race itself, but they'll be pushing in 100, maybe 150 miles of training every week, week on week, year in, year out. And I think what we're talking about there is the very end of the spectrum, where for the majority of the population, running anything up to a marathon is actually very beneficial.
Tamer, Hugh Butler, another problem that we've heard about is how runners sweat and how much salt is actually in the blood. Can you talk about those problems with some of these ultra athletes that you've looked at?
So like Greg was saying, the intensity really, you have to decrease your intensity when you run longer races. And so what you also have to do is you have to eat. So when you sweat, most of the water and all of the salt really it gets lost through sweat. You don't urinate quite as much. So it becomes more of a delicate balance. And so the problem that we worry about and what I see is a condition called hyponatremia, which is low blood salt. And low blood salt can actually kill runners, and it has, because what happens is the sodium is mostly outside of the cells and potassium is mostly inside of the cells, and they don't really cross the cell walls very well, but water can. So water will flow from areas of lower concentration to higher concentration. So when you develop hyponatremia or low blood sodium, the water is actually going to flow into the cells and the cells will swell. This becomes a problem in two parts of your body. One is the brain and the other your lungs. So with hyponatremia that is severe, the lungs will actually fill up with fluid. You can get pulmonary edema. But what's more serious is the brain can swell. And because the brain is encased within your skull, which is rigid, if the brain swells too much, it actually will push the brain stem out of the foramen magnum. And that's actually how people die.
How often does that happen?
It is rare. So we see it, I think the incidence is like less than 1%. However, it's explosive. So people come into the starting line at the best condition of their life, and they could end up in the hospital in comas and even die, you know, before they reach the finish line. So it's very, very rare, but it can kill somebody who's very fit very quickly.
So talk about how all this plays into how much water you're supposed to drink, because we think about a marathon route and every couple miles there's a water station. You're supposed to take in a lot of water. Obviously, you get thirsty. The more you run, the way you deal with water probably is a little bit different, right, Tamara?
Well, I think where we started to get into problems was when runners were told to drink beyond thirst, drink as much as they could, and, you know, don't dehydrate. And then races, you know, catered to that. We started like putting water stops every mile, every half mile. These water belts came into play. And so people were drinking above the body's signal, which is thirst. And when you do that, you run into problems. So again, too, I think if people drank to thirst and heeded their body signs, they wouldn't get into the problem. This is when we try to outsmart our bodies with how much water we think that we need or how much salt that we think that we need, is where the problems began.
Let's go to Peter, who's calling from Jacksonville, Florida. Hi there, Peter. You're on Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to ask about the effects on the joints. The knees, the feet, the ankles. I've run a couple of marathons when I was 40. I'm now 70, and I think I'm beginning to feel the effects of all that training.
Okay, well, that's a great question. And Greg White, I know this is something you've looked at. Is it really bad for the joints? People say it's going to destroy your knees running these very long distances.
It's a really interesting question. And I think actually it's surrounded by dogma. I think, you know, we often hear about this. You see it written in the press. You hear about it on the radio, on the television. The fact is that actually linear endurance events, so effectively something like running or swimming or cycling, those things that require repetitive action over and over again, actually are very good for the joints. What we do is we actually see very little wear and tear on the joints. It is, in fact, it tends to be the impact sport. So things like, you know, for the Americans, it's football. For the British, it's football. But let's call it soccer. For things like baseball, for things like basketball, where you're actually having traumatic injury of the joint. In other words, where you have impact. What that does is that damages the joint, and that is the start of fundamentally what is the osteoarthritic process. But actually, in general, what we find with endurance athletes, linear endurance athletes, their joints are in really good condition up to a very old age.
Let's hear from Tyler, who's calling from Boise, Idaho. Tyler, you're actually an ultra marathoner yourself?
Yes, I am, yes.
Okay, well, tell us about this.
Well, they're a great way to get out and really see nature and kind of things like that. And it's a great community of supportive folks because you have to have all those aid stations like you talked about every few miles to eat enough. And that's kind of maybe the biggest challenge for people is learning how to eat when you're out there for 30 hours at a time because you do lose your appetite. Some of the hormones repress that. And that's the biggest problem that we see is people fail to eat and then they run into blood sugar problems and things like that.
Well, Tyler, good luck with your ultra marathons. You know, when you say it's a great way to see nature, I think about, you know, renting a convertible and driving that way. But, you know, this also works, I suppose. Tyler is talking about eating being a very important part of it. It seems like these ultra marathoners need to learn how to do this, including things like what they're going to put in their stomachs during and before the race.
Correct. I think we found that gastrointestinal distress is probably hit 60-70% of all ultra runners. And so the advice is really you have to learn what works for you. You know, we found there's some data that showed that if you drank a little bit more, you had a little bit more fat that seemed to coat, but it didn't work for everybody. And everybody's is an N of one. And that's where the training, again, comes into. You have to find what works for your body, what you can tolerate, because you definitely have to eat and drink during these long runs.
I'm John Dankosky, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And we're talking with Tamara Hugh Butler and Greg White about ultra marathon running, and we're taking some phone calls from people who take part in this amazing sport, running hundreds of miles sometimes at a time, like Josh in, I believe it's Kingston, Massachusetts. Josh, tell us your story. So you're an ultra marathon runner? Go ahead.
Yeah. So I actually just completed my first ultra marathon this past weekend in Wakefield, Massachusetts. And it was a timed 12-hour race where runners were challenged to see how many 5K circuits they could run in those 12 hours. It was 85 degrees. It was, very, very low cloud cover. And in my first ultra, I actually was fortunate enough to guide a friend who is visually impaired who also ran that ultra. He completed 54 miles, and I ended up completing 61. And the two of us sort of chatted about it before and after, and we both agreed that the reason we were signing up for this race and it being our first ultra is because I don't think anyone ever gets comfortable at a marathon distance, but we got to the point where we knew that we could do 26.2 miles, and we wanted to see what our bodies were capable of. And the two of us sort of surpassing that 50-mile mark at last weekend's ultra, got us scratching our heads at what's the next distance and, how far can we push ourselves and how far, can our bodies take us?
Well, Josh, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Greg, I'm sure that you hear this all the time from people. They want to push themselves past that barrier that they think is there. I mean, should there be any concerns amongst people? We've talked about some of the potential pitfalls, medically speaking, but is there anything else that people should think about before they decide, yeah, you know what, I'm going to go run 50 miles at a time?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story listening because, you know, what we've done, the humans are wonderful at it, is that we continue to challenge ourselves on a regular basis. And, you know, we've just spoken about where the marathon was. And now if you think about events like triathlons. We've now moved to half Ironman. We've moved to Ironman triathlons. There are DECA Ironman triathlons around the world. We now run up and down mountains. So we are constantly pushing ourselves to the absolute limit. I think the thing to remember is that the human is uniquely placed for endurance. In fact, we're the best endurance animal on the planet, bar none. And our physiology fundamentally can cope with endurance. I think where the problem really does come is one of two areas. Number one is obviously if there is an underlying problem, and particularly if you're taking up endurance running or endurance exercise late in life, then the potential is that really what you should be doing is making sure that everything is good under the bonnet, as it were. That's really, really important. I think the other thing is as well is actually training, is that what you should never do is, and I see it far too regularly, is that you see the you know, you watch the Boston Marathon, you watch the New York Marathon on telly, and you think, well, that must be easy because there's 50,000 people out there doing it. I don't need to train. And actually, you know, training's fundamental, not only to keeping healthy, but it's also fundamental to the enjoyment of what you do, because if you're not well-conditioned, it is absolute purgatory while you're out there.
Well, I have to ask you both, and we just have a little bit of time left. Let's go to the other end of the spectrum, though, because a lot of people want to dive in and just run 26 miles. But there was a study out this week in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, which suggests that just 5 minutes of running a day could give you the same heart benefits as longer periods of exercise. I don't know, Tamara, is this too good to be true?
I think it's a spectrum, and it all depends on where you start from. If you just sit on the couch and you've never done anything, yeah, 5 minutes is better than nothing. So it's again, along a continuum. So it's like for the people who don't exercise, yeah, I think that's better than nothing. But, you know, I think we do want to hit, like, what's good for fitness, and that's regular endurance exercise. I think the ACSM has 30 minutes every day. So, I mean, we want to work up to that to derive the biggest health benefits. So, but 5 to 10 minutes is better than probably most people are doing right now.
Certainly. I'm not going to go out and run 50 miles anytime soon. But Tamara Hugh Butler, Assistant Professor of Exercise Science at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Greg White, a Professor of Applied Sport and Exercise Science at Liverpool John Moores University in the UK. Thank you so much, Greg.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for your time.